And we believe that only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we can be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight we've got Steve Kay coming from the Skyland Group. Had the opportunity of hearing his story a few weeks back at another clubhouse, and I really want to hear it again because there was a lot to learn, and he's agreed to come share with us, and I'm so happy that he's here. Welcome, Steve. I'm Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. Let me get a few things organized here. You know what the biggest lie in AA is, don't you? I'm going to only talk about recovery tonight. You know I'm not going to finish talking about drinking until 5 till 9 if I had to say that. So, I'm Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. And over the years, I've become a very spiritual speaker. So I always like to start out with a story that talks about spirituality. It's a little cute story that you'll relate to my drinking. There's this school teacher, and she goes to her first day of class. And she wants to get to know some of the students. You know, they're new to her. She doesn't know them. She's new to town. And so she says, I'd like y'all to talk about something that's happened to you and relate it to some principle or moral or something like that. And so this one girl raised her hand. She says, I think I got it. She says, I'm a farmer's daughter, and my dad took me out to the hen house, and we had this basket, and we were putting eggs in it. About 3 or 4 fell out. She said, well, what's the moral of that story? She said, well, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. She goes, oh, okay, got it. That's very good. Second one's a little girl raised hand and said, well, almost the same thing happened to me. I went with my daddy out to the hen house, and there was 4 eggs. And he said, tomorrow morning, there'll be 4 chickens there. And they come in the morning, and there's only 3 chickens there. She says, what's the moral of that story? He said, you know, don't count your chickens before they hatch. Getting how this is working, right? So then this kid in the back row, boy, his name is Larry, he says, I'm not a, you know, I don't live on a farm. My daddy was a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and he was shot down over Vietnam. He had grabbed a bottle of bourbon, a machete, and a machine gun, and he, you know, parachuted out, and he drank the whiskey on the way down, and then when he hit the ground, he took his machete out, killed as many as he could, and then he shot the rest with the machine gun. I said, well, Larry, that's a tough story. What's the moral of that story? He says, well, like my mom always says, don't fuck with daddy when he's been drinking. I know this is a very spiritual group, so I hesitated to tell that story. I love that story. I can't help myself. My sobriety date is September 21st, 1983, and I'm grateful for that. I am married to Kim, who's here tonight. I've got 2 children, Jessica and Catherine, and I'm very grateful because I know I wouldn't have any of that if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have my sobriety, I wouldn't have my family, I wouldn't have the relationships in my life without Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to practice that gratitude that many of y'all do. But the reason I'm here tonight is to talk about how I got here, and then what it was like when I got here, and what it's like today. I grew up in most of y'all are going to know this, I grew up in an alcoholic home. You don't end up with a father in AA 4 years in front of you unless you grew up in a drunk house. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to talk about my own drinking. But as by way of background, I grew up in an alcoholic home. And growing up in an alcoholic home, for many of us, because I know there's many people in here that grew up in the same type of home I did, I know today that we're powerless over alcohol. If you're an alcoholic, you are powerless over alcohol. So that means alcohol's in charge, and certainly alcohol was in charge of my family. And it was in charge of our house, and it was in charge of our lives. And almost everybody that we knew drank alcoholically. I mean, I would say basically I grew up around people who drank alcoholically, and that's what I remember. And it isn't the reason I drank, because once I started drinking, I loved drinking, just like most of the people in this room loved drinking when they started drinking. But just by way of background, I grew up in a household where there were all the effects that come from alcoholism. And I experienced all those effects as a child. I experienced all those effects as a teenager. And then I delivered all of those same effects to other people that were in my life once I started drinking. I came into AA when I was 24 years old. I drank from when I was 15 until I was 24. Now, I drank before that, but I defined my drinking by the fact that I was a daily drinker from when I was 15 till I was 24. Some people say, well, when did you start morning drinking? And I didn't know there was morning drinking. I thought you always drank. In high school, I would say that there was a lot of different people that I came across, but I mostly hung out with people who drank like I did. Now, we were back in the days when drugs were pretty free and pretty easy to get, and liquor was pretty easy to get. I know as I listen to people, it's become a little more intense now in how people, what they have to do to be able to get alcohol or get drugs or whatever they have to do to stay high. But I was a daily drinker, like I said. When I was 15, we used to meet before high school and drink pretty much every morning before we went to school. And the reason that I drank like that is because that's what I did. If you'd have come up to me when I was 16 years, and I know they did this, you know, in high school, they probably had these drug assemblies and all that stuff, but who would attend those things anyway? I mean, I didn't. I don't remember them. I probably heard it in class or whatever, but I wasn't really in a space where I was listening at all. And alcohol, you know, a lot of people say alcohol was a solution. I don't really know if it was a solution or not, because I can't remember not drinking. I don't know how to explain it other than to say, you know, from when I started drinking, I was drinking. It wasn't like there was, I was physically stronger, so it didn't affect me the way it did in my 20s. But when I was a teenager, I drank like I did when I was in my 20s. And the thing, looking back on it now, I know I was drinking alcoholically from the start, was because I always drank after I was already drunk. You know, normal people, if they get drunk, they may say something like, you may hear them say something like this: I don't want to have any more. I'm feeling a little tipsy. Okay? I mean, I don't remember feeling tipsy, because I went so fast by that when I was drunk, I was drinking more. And that's what, you know, looking back on it now, that's part of the symptoms of alcoholism. And I think one of the things that started to happen to me early on was I started to go, what I like to say is, instead of saying I assorted myself with the wrong people, I say I sought my own level. Okay, because I was really the kind of guy you should not be assorting yourself with. Wasn't the other way around. I was like trying to recruit people who were kind of good people into the alcoholic way of life. Now, I didn't know it at the time. That's what I was doing. We used to go to, there was this, and this is the best description of it I can give. There was a bar on Piedmont Road. I don't even know if it's still there. It probably is. Ken's Tavern. And still there. I'm glad there's people still out there for me. And next door, there was this Harvest Moon Saloon. Now, that's where you listen to music, and everything was kind of like, those weren't my people. Okay, they were listening to jazz. They were sitting at the tables. In Ken's Tavern, they were playing pool. They were getting in fights. They were drinking liquor, and they were drinking beer, and they were getting in trouble. And so I tended, my friends and I would go to go to Harvest Moon Saloon, and they'd all walk right into Harvest Moon Saloon, and I'd just saunter on down to the bar where I felt the most comfortable, which was Ken's Tap. Now, every once in a while, then, I'd get a little too drunk, and I'd feel like I needed to go down and help some people down at Harvest Moon Saloon. And I was a really good fighter, and I say that with no, absolutely all humility. And the reason I say I was a good fighter is because this is the kind of fighter I was. And I remember one night specifically, I was sitting up at the bar and I was drunk and obviously talking to the wrong woman because some big guy started talking to me. And I said, look, man, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to offend you. I'm going to leave. You know, let me buy you a drink. And I bought him a drink. And then I went out and I looked through the window until he turned around. He was sitting at the bar. I went and got a big rock, and I walked back in the bar and tapped him on the shoulder, and I just smashed him in the face with the rock, and I ran out. Well, I won, right? I was an excellent fighter. You know, but that's the kind of person I was. I mean, when I was drinking, those were the things that I did. You know, I was not of high moral character. You know, you could kid yourself about me, but when I was drinking, that's what I did. That's how I acted. And eventually, you get a driver's license, which is not good if you're a daily drinker. I used to hear Bob Meadows, God rest his soul. I remember the first time I heard his story, and he said that that he was afraid, you know, he was drinking and driving so much and getting caught that he was afraid. So instead of quitting drinking, of course, he quit driving. And I always identified with that because I understood that. And I would have gotten a lot more DUIs and only ended up getting one because the police always showed up, and by the time they got there, I was already doing something worse. So they would arrest me for something else, you know, assault with a deadly weapon or assault or battery. Or criminal, my favorite is in Georgia, they have this criminal destruction of property. I don't know, has anybody else been arrested for criminal destruction of property? Okay, I got a couple. Usually don't get many of those, but and there's actually 3 degrees of that, and I've been arrested for all 3 degrees, so that's not good. But anyway, I had, I think, total 8 car wrecks in various people's cars. And one night, actually, after sobriety, me and Kim and a friend of ours named Marshall were driving, and we totaled up how many cars we had wrecked between the three of us. And we knew some insurance agent was sleeping well because he knew that only one of us could drive if we were all driving together. So I went to, and then after high school, I got in plenty of trouble. And then after high school, I said, well, I'm going to go to University of Georgia. So at that time, it was a very hard school, and there wasn't much partying going on there. Okay. That I participated. And so I went down there, and I lasted 2 years, about 5 quarters. And the reason that I did was not because my grades were bad. My grades weren't bad. But I had been arrested by all 5 different police forces that are down there. And I figured any place that had 5 police forces, you ought to leave town. And I got out of town and came back to Georgia State. But there was a couple things, looking back on it, that really will describe how my drinking was at that time. I was in a fraternity, and we had this big party. They called it Wild West. And the fraternity was it was big enough where we had about 2,000 people at this party. And if I can describe it to you, our fraternity house was two stories high, and it had a flat roof. And you could go out on the roof, which we would with lawn chairs doing drinking and all that, and you could look out over the crack that was down there. We had beer trucks, but we had these big golden grain, big trash cans with golden grain punch in them. My brother had come up for a visit, which I don't know why anybody would have let him come up there, but he came up there for a visit. And he and I were sitting there and talking, and I said, yeah, and I was drunk, and I said, which I was all the time, and I said, you know, I think I can jump into that punch down there. It was this big trash can. And you got to imagine, there's like 2,000 people, and they're all getting in the punch. And so my brother said the important thing. He said, oh, I don't think you can hit that can from here. And I walked out and dove, you know, feet first, and I went right in the punch, and the punch, you know, splashed out all over people. And the important thing is not how crazy I was, because I was crazy. But the important thing is that when I walked away, all those people were saying, that guy is crazy. And I felt great about that. You know, because that's where, I was like out of Animal House. I mean, that's how I used to keep my motorcycle upstairs in the fraternity house. I had to flee the police several times, you know, come down the stairs on my motorcycle, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was craziness. And eventually I moved back to Atlanta because, like I said, the heat was on. And I went to Georgia State in downtown. And I drank, went to school, got decent grades, but I was drinking all the time. And I remember one thing I would just mention. You know, talking about as I started to go down this steep slide in alcoholism, I wanted to be around people who drank like I drank. And so, some people remember this, the Atlanta City Jail was right here, Georgia State was behind me, and there was a package store right to your left. As soon as I got out of class, because I only went to class 2 days a week, but as soon as I got out of class, I would go over and sit on that wall with my bottle of whiskey and drink with those folks who couldn't make sense. Because I felt comfortable drinking right there. And I was maybe 21, 22 years old at the time. So my drinking had progressed to where I was, had I not had a family supporting me, had I not been in school, I'd have been on the streets. But because of my own devices, I certainly couldn't maintain what I was doing. Just to get you how... So by this time, I was drinking all the time. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of car accidents, a lot of really bad events were going on. But I started to get physically sick. And I could just tell things weren't going well. I went to, in January of 1983, this is about 9 months before I came into AA, I'd gone to work, and my boss drank alcoholically, thank God, or else I would have been fired immediately. I mean, because I was drinking, you know, you don't just go from drinking every day all the time to work and stop drinking. I mean, at least not in my case, it's not how it worked. So I was, thank God I had a boss who drank like I drank. So we'd go at lunch, you know, the first day I worked for him, I asked him, do you want to go to lunch? He said, yeah, let's go to lunch. So he picked out a place that I knew served people. And sure enough, we sat down. He said, I'll have a martini. Now, to me, a martini is just vodka in a glass. And I used to order vodka in a glass. That's what I tell. But I said, hey, I'll take a martini too. We had three or four martinis, enough to make sure that I could make it through the rest of the day. So I started working for him. Well, anyway, I was working for him maybe 6 months, and he and I decided we were going to go to the Sugar Bowl. And it's about this time of year. And so we get the idea that we're going to fly to Sarasota to go to the Sugar Bowl, which is in New Orleans. I mean, y'all know Florida and this outward. But what we're going to do is we're going to go up the coast and take a leisurely drive. And so we get down there about 30 hours before the night that you got to be there. So we fly there and we start driving up the coast. And we're stopping at every beach and places to eat oysters. And we're drinking a lot of booze. And we get all the way up to New Orleans. It takes us like, I don't know, should have taken us like 12 hours or something, or 14 hours. It took us like 23 or 24 hours because we had to stop to drink and eat a lot. And so we get up there, and so we get a place at the Marriott, which we had already gotten. And me and there was these four girls that were there. Now, they were not girlfriends. They were drinking buddies of mine. And so I introduced my boss to my drinking buddies. And at about 4 o'clock in the morning, one of the events that started to drive me to AA happened. I was walking down the hall, and I used to have this drinking outfit. I don't know how many of y'all had drinking outfits, but I used to, when I started to drink, and I was like drinking a lot, like it was, this is like 40 hours after I started drinking, I would always end up in boxer shorts, one of those white beater t-shirts, you know what I'm talking about, with the little strips, and a bandana around my head, and I thought I was good looking. And I would wear flip-flops too. Forgot those. And so I was walking down the hall, and there was this really attractive woman that I needed to talk to. And she was standing right in the hall. Here it is, the Marriott. I'm saying, you know, look, somebody's delivering this woman for me. It's great. I'm talking to her. And, you know, now I'm about 20 pounds heavier, bloated. I mean, if you'd asked me then, I was looking good. But so I start talking to her, and I don't really notice out of the corner of my eye, she's got her boyfriend standing right there with her, and I don't really notice him. So he whacks me in the face with a bottle of liquor right across the nose, and blood starts spewing everywhere. And these four girls that I used to drink with, they come running out of the room, and I'm telling you, I wasn't much of a fighter, but those women, they whipped his ass. I mean, they damn put it on him. Well, anyway, they finally dragged me down to Charity Hospital, and I'll never forget it to this day, because, you know, getting your face blown up. So the doctor, two things happen. The doctor is, you know, they clean me all up, and the doctor's got me on the gurney, and I'm very lucky because there's a plastic surgeon, you know, they do kind of volunteer work. He happens to be there, so he's going to show up my face. I mean, it's all the way through. And he says, look, son, I'm going to have to put a bunch of stitches in your face. I need to know how much you've been drinking. And, you know, with policemen, I mean, it's two beers. I mean, you know that automatically. But with a doctor, you've got to kind of tell him. So I'm trying to put it into drinks that he would understand. You know, I'm doing the math in my head. And you got to remember, by now, it's like 45 hours, 42 of which I've been drinking. And so I'm trying to add up all the drinks, and near as I can tell. So I say to the guy, I say, I think I've had about 100 drinks. And he looked at me shocked, and I was like, well, I told him the truth. I don't know what he's looking at. And he said, well, then I'm going to just give you a local. And he put 27 stitches in my face using local anesthetic. And I don't remember feeling anything while he was sewing me up. I mean, I was so drunk. And so afterwards, I'm getting ready to leave. I'm checking out. You know, I'm all cleaned up. It's already starting to be painful. So I said, well, are you going to give me a prescription for pain pills? He said, no. He goes, not with as much as you've been drinking. He said, I just suggest you keep drinking. So I went by McDonald's, got some straws, and I started drinking bourbon out of a straw the next morning. Now that, to me, is alcoholic insanity. Anyway, like I said, I was having physical problems. So I went to my doctor, and my doctor said, hey, you're starting to have heart problems. You're starting to, you know, I don't know what's going on with your pulse rate, with your blood pressure. You know, there's some enzymes here. You know, how much are you drinking? Now, I've already told y'all how much I drank. So I say, what words that come out of my mouth is 2 6-packs. So I'm about to tell him 2 6-packs a day. And he says, which is a lie anyway, but I'm about to tell him 2 6-packs. I figured that'll give him the idea. And he says, 2 6-packs a week? Oh, my God. You're drinking. I said, my God, I didn't tell him. You know, he'd have been driven crazy. So anyway, so I stopped drinking for 10 days, of which I had a drink in the middle of it. But I promised him, and my blood pressure started coming down, my pulse rate, all the stuff you would expect to see if somebody's drinking too much, and just stop. I stopped for 10 days, but as soon as he told me I could drink again, man, I was out of there, and I drank for 30 more days. And it was nothing special. That night was nothing special. I was at Good Old Days, which I know is closed because I went by there the other night. Good Old Days on Roswell Road, and I had not anything special to drink. I had a couple pitchers of beer, a bunch of shots of tequila, and I got in the car to drive up. And the next thing I knew, some policeman pulled me over. And he leaned into the window and he said, driver's license, insurance, registration, whatever they said at the time. And I gave him all the stuff. And I said, officer, why are you stopping me? I'm sure I said it like this. But he understood what I was saying because he talked to drunks all the time, I'm sure. And he said, you ran through 3 stoplights. I said, really? I didn't know I ran through 3 stoplights. I'm sure I was just driving along and didn't see it. And, you know, those things happen. So he gets me out of the car and he says, would you say you're, he's got me standing up. He can already tell I can't stand up. But he says, would you say your ABC's backwards? And I started laughing. He said, what are you laughing about? I said, saying backwards, I can't even say them forwards. He said, get in the car. So, like I told you, I mean, I can tell you 100 stories of bad things that happened to me, wreck, you know, rest, all the stuff that happened to an alcoholic. But for some reason that night, and I don't know why to this day, he said some things to me, I said some things to him, and you know, I was in jail again. I called Larry. I said, you know, I'm ready to go to one of those AA meetings. And and I came to a Thursday night NABA men's meeting. And actually, Clyde H. gave me my chip September 21st, 1983. And I've not had a drink since. I used to say things like I hadn't found it necessary to take a drink since, but I just hadn't drank since. I'm sure it's been necessary, but I haven't had a drink since. The guy who came and got me the next day, Craig Ward, he's passed on. Craig was my first sponsor. I want to talk about a few things in sobriety, and I promise I'll finish at 5 till 9. I want to talk a few things about sobriety that I think are important to me. And I'm just saying them because they're important to me and they're things that have helped me in my sobriety. First of all, sponsorship. I've had 5 sponsors. One of my sponsors is here tonight, Don W. He's in the back of the room. And I tell you, about 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, I was in a tough sled and tough shape. And I can tell you right now that you don't know when you're going to need a sponsor, but if you got a sponsor, that's what you need. I don't know how else to say. And I'll always be grateful for Don to how much crap he had to listen to me every day for probably a year. I mean, just I was in a shit storm, and he was there for me. And so I want to recognize Don's here tonight. But they really have talked about 5 ideas, these 5 sponsors. I was thinking about this tonight. First of all of them have been people who have gone to a lot of meetings. They participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of them are in service, some of them weren't, some of all that stuff. But they all went to a lot of meetings, all the sponsors I've had. We lived out of town a couple times, and the sponsors that I had out of town went to a lot of meetings. They all work with others. You know, they all did some type of service work, whether it was in the service structure or it was one-on-one with other alcoholics, or they help with the group or whatever, but they work with other people in AA. And I'll say this in the way that I think about it, is that all the sponsors I've had have had a reliance on a power greater than themselves. Whether it's, you know, I always like to say this because it's funny, I'm Jewish. I've had two born-again sponsors, and that hadn't confused me or them. And but they've all had a reliance on a power greater than themselves, whether it was AA or whether it was a God of their understanding. They all participated in the literature in some form or fashion. And they all participated in the steps, whether they felt like the steps worked them or they felt like they worked the steps. I've always had a home group. Like I said, we've lived out of town several times. I had my first two home groups, and I'm still a member of the Skyland group. My first two home groups were Skyland and the Sunday morning 11:30 meeting, which I was a member of for about 3 years, and a member of Skyland. And today I call Skyland my home group, but when we moved out of town, we still had home groups that we called our home group. I would break my sobriety into three parts. First, I would say there was frantic sobriety. And for a lot of y'all, frantic sobriety doesn't last very long. But for me, it lasted like 10 years. Okay? And let me tell you what that works like, who looks like. That's when I'm helping you whether you want help or not. Okay? Like if I spot you, like you need some help, I'm going to track you down and help you. Okay? And I had sponsorees. I had lots of sponsorees. That's not what I called them at the time. And I got confused between working the steps and lawn work. Like I used to think it was good to have sponsorees do your lawn work. And I used to tell them that's service work. You know, is doing our lawn. And I would sit out my lawn. I'm telling it like it was. I used to sit out in my lawn chair with a cup of coffee and watch my sponsorees do lawn work at my house and talk to me. And if you think I was listening to them, I wasn't listening to them. I was trying to get them to do my lawn work. But somehow they stayed sober and so did I. Then after about 7 or 8 years, I had this sponsor, Dick Sawyer. He lives down in Florida. And Dick told me one night, he walked up to me, he goes, "I really like how you're working the steps, Steve." And I said, "Thanks, Dick." He said, "But," he said, "we'd like you to work on some of the defects that are bothering us, just not the ones that are bothering you." But I didn't relent. You know, I still made it 10 more years. You know, Bill R., who comes here quite often, Bill told me when I had 90 days, and we had a funny conversation. I had 90 days. I was at the men's retreat. He said, "Klinger, you're in good shape in AA." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you can stay sober on ego alone for 20 years. I know I did it." And he said, "You're looking like you're going to want to do it." And I saw him, you know, after I had about 22 or 23 years, I said, "You were wrong." He said, "You're right. It's more." Anyway, then I would say that I had what I'll call is living in society. And this is like the married, children, career. And it's one thing when you're in AA a long time, because remember, like the Big Book was written after 4 years. People didn't have a long time in sobriety when they wrote the Big Book. I learned so much from other people that are in sobriety a long time. Not everybody who's in sobriety a long time has what I want. That's not what I'm saying. I mean, there are some people that are in AA that, you know, I can tell you right now, I don't want what they want, what they got, and I stay away from them. Okay? I don't give a shit how long they got in sobriety. Okay? But the people that I see them, they have contentment, they have happiness, they have what we call in another program that I go to, the priceless gift of serenity. you know, they get it in a certain way, and I try and follow those things that they do. And several years ago, I had a wake-up call in sobriety, and I was about 23, 24 years sober. And what I had done was, I think, and this is, you know, my story, is that I had lost some of the reliance on higher power that I'd had for a lot of years. I kind of had a lot of success, business success, family success, a lot of things that had gone my way. And I think I got to a place where I lost not the focus on AA, because I was still going to meetings, I still was talking to people, but other things had become as important as my participation in AA. And I was very fortunate that I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was here for me. Now, I never stopped going to meetings. I never stopped doing some of the things, but I kind of lost my way and came to a place in sobriety where I needed to really go back to all the things that my sponsors had taught me all those years. And I had to redouble my efforts. A lot of things, I like to say, conspired to make me recommit to the program of recovery. And I'm not talking about, now you're getting in the opinion part. Most of what I say is opinion anyway, but here's my opinion about it. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can come for one of two reasons. I can come for relief, which I will get, or I can come here for recovery, which I have to go get. You know, for me, I spent a lot of years getting relief in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, as things from the outside world, you know, the common sense things, you know, how are you doing? How does it look? All those things got in the way of me really needing to focus my efforts on the spiritual program that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I did a lot of things. I recommitted to a sponsorship relationship. I recommitted to reading the literature. I recommitted to doing my morning meditation and my prayer and the things that I needed to do to have a relationship with a higher power. I recommitted to my family and to my relationship with my wife and my children. I recommitted to the people that I worked with instead of the job that I did. And those things, and I look back on it, and it was extraordinarily painful to change my attitude about those things. And it was extraordinarily tough for me to move in a different direction. But from my standpoint, you know, the results have been the things that I talked about earlier. You know, the priceless gift of serenity, you know, which is so hard to get. The loving relationships that I have today. Nothing's perfect. Nothing ever is. But the commitment of people rather than things. The commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. The ability to have a relationship with a God of my understanding and that relationship as I define it. There's so many things that I have learned in sobriety about myself and about how I stay sober and about what I need to do to have the life that I want to live. And it comes really in so many different ways. It comes from, I heard a speaker here, a 545 speaker, spoke at Jackie's birthday, I think it was. And the guy said, he said, why don't you give out strokes instead of pokes? I don't know why I heard it, But that little thing, you know, am I? So I ask myself these questions. When I do my inventory, I ask myself these questions. Am I going up to people after the meeting or before the meeting and ask them how they're doing and listening to them, especially if they're new? Am I in my home group? Am I talking to people about what's going on with them? Am I trying to give of myself? Okay. My inventories were much different than that. They were not, what can I do for you? It was more, what can I do for me? And look, I'm not, you know, after 27 years of sobriety, the only wisdom that that's been imparted on me has been that Alcoholics Anonymous is the place that I have to come to recover. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. I'm glad you came. I'm sure everyone else does too. The seventh tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, but your generosity helps us bring fine speakers like tonight and keep some of those stories up on the web. NABAClub.org now has about 90 speakers who share their experience, strength, and hope for the alcoholic who still suffers. Again, that's NABAClub.org. And I've asked Greg to hand out the chips.
Here in Napa, we have a chip system. I'm going to go real quickly. Great story, man. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, really enjoyed it. White chip, red chip. Come in, come back. Let it go, let God. Anybody? Nobody. 30 days of the silver chip. Take us. So, keep coming back. 90 days, red chip, take us. Right. 6 months, gold chip. And then, green chip, nine months. All right. We'll take us. All right. And a blue chip, 1 year, multiple there.
How many is it? 10 years.
My name is Paul. I'm an addict. January 2nd, 2001, after New Year's. It's my last drink. And I've been going to NA, celebrate recovery, mostly with my church. And my father just went back up here, so I'm here supporting him. So,
Welcome to White Chip one more time. Just in case, anybody shy, speak up again.
Thank you, Greg. Okay, we can make announcements, AA related announcements now. Yes,
Patrick. My name is Patrick. I smell a real alcoholic. Always looking for volunteers out in the garden.
And it is looking good these days. Frank.
Down there on Livingstone.
Oh, Daryl, yes.
At every AA meeting, there's an opportunity for service. So tonight, if there's anybody that's a student that doesn't know how to clean the coffee area, I'd be glad to instruct you on how to do that. So you know that there's an opportunity. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Daryl. Frank.
January 9th, we now have the membership meeting up in this room at 1 o'clock. And January 9th at 1 o'clock. Remember, we're going downstairs.
This Sunday. This Sunday.
Probably not call it.
Good news. See Bobby for literature. Well, next week we've got Debbie O, past president of NAVA. She's telling her story. And the week after that, Alonzo from Heavy Hitters, Alonzo J, will be here for the 17th. So that's good. Now, if you wanted to see what our roster is looking like, and there may be a speaker that you might want to plan on in the future, we are now scheduled up to March 1st. So you can go on NAVAClub.org, and there's a roster that has first name, initial, and homebrew. And so we got a really great lineup. It's going to be super wonderful. Anything else? Okay, we appreciate help, and Daryl gives fantastic coffee cleaning lessons. And for those who will, please join us in Lord's Prayer.
John W., would you?
Our Father, our Father, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
There's a man in the corner with a
I just don't listen to a lot of